Rock critic Ken Tucker hosts Hearing Secret Harmonies every Wednesday at 3:30. Tomorrow afternoon at 3:30, Francis Davis hosts Interval, a review of new jazz releases, and Friday at 3:30, Bill Van Wert will review a new film. It's a minute after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on 91FM, WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. And with me is Leonard Maltin, the editor of the Popular Guide TV Movies, which is a collection of capsule reviews of films shown on television, along with the director, the starring actors, the running time, plus a rating from bomb to 4 stars. Maltin revises this book every couple of years, and the 1983-84 edition has just been published. It includes 15,000 movies, including many made-for-TV movies, and the book is a lot thicker than it even was the last time around. Maltin has been writing about film since he was a teenager. He put together the Film Fan Monthly. He's written for many magazines, and his books include Of Mice and Magic, A History of American Animated Cartoons, The Great Movie Comedians, The Disney Films, Movie Comedy Teams, and The Art of the Cinematographer. And the new edition of TV Movies has just been published, and for any of you who are listening during our fundraiser, this is, in fact, the TV Movies book that we were offering as a special premium, and if you are one of the recipients of that book, I'm sure you'll especially appreciate what Leonard Maltin has to say. A little later, we'll be opening up our phones for any questions or comments that you have about movies. Leonard Maltin, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Let's talk a little bit about The Guide before we wind our way into some other areas
sure.
of films.
Yes, it is thick, but there's something that friends have been pointing out to me that I didn't know, which is that we've added 1,500 movies to this edition from the last one, but it has the same number of pages as the last one.
It doesn't look it. I have both of them on
I know.
My
well, they use thicker paper and smaller type.
Oh.
So they perform some sort of strange mystical ledger domain that I don't understand, but
yeah,
there it is.
You have to weigh them. And
yeah, exactly, exactly.
How did The Guide first develop?
I wish I could give you some romantic saga. It was a case of my walking into an editor's office who was looking for somebody to do just this kind of book and said, would you like to do it and how would you approach it? And immediately I knew the kind of things I would want to put into a guide of this sort, and he liked what I had to say, and I did it. And the only real novelty to all that was that I was 17 years old at the time, and I was graduating from high school, and he had faith in me, but he was a little afraid to tell his superiors that he was hiring a 17-year-old kid to do the book. So he didn't until I started handing in material, and then, you know, he could show it to them and everything was okay. And The funny part for me has been that it started out to be just a consumer guide, a kind of a bedside consultant reader for the kind of fellow who would stay up late and watch the movies at 11:30 at night. And it's developed into something that's used by the film industry and by TV people and by newspaper people. And it's gone on to almost take on a life of its own, which doesn't displease me in the slightest. It's just kind of surprising to me and keeps me on my toes, because I get a lot of mail from readers and they always catch any kind of mistake or alert me to different things. And it's become quite a kind of a life project, almost a Frankenstein, but not in a negative sense, but only in the sense that it's become a creation that's almost out of my control.
Do you ever reread the reviews that you wrote when you were 17? Do they hold up?
Some of them do, and a lot of them don't. And I think it would be—I think that's as it should be. If I haven't grown in the intervening years, I would think there'd be something wrong with me. And so, sure, I go back and I read them, and I say, "Gee, that isn't really well written. Let me see if I can redo that." And then I do, or I'll go back and I'll say, "Well, that's okay, but gee, I really should have acknowledged this or that." And so I'll redo the write-up just to make note of certain things or certain facets of the film, or maybe somebody's contribution to the film that we didn't note it before. I'll add a screenplay credit where I think it's particularly noteworthy, or a music credit where it's particularly noteworthy. And I know we're both jazz buffs, you and I, and I've added a lot of things that are relevant to that in the book the past few editions, and that gives me a kind of a special pride to be able to do that.
What are your most argued with reviews?
Let's see. What are my most argued with reviews? Well, one of them is a film that's on television tonight, Taxi Driver, which is a film that I didn't like, and that's purely on a visceral or emotional level. I didn't like it. I don't. I mean, it's not that I don't admire the craftsmanship of the movie or something like that. But I found it a very unpleasant experience, and I'm not sure what the film really accomplished. At the same time, I'm aware of how many people really like that movie and really admire the movie. So in a case like that, I gave it a fairly negative or mixed to negative review, but then acknowledge that other people feel that, you know, it's better. I try to do that where I know I'm doing something that's controversial or maybe against, out of the mainstream. I at least want to, you know, not be dogmatic about it, and I try to do that. Alien is a film that turned me off and that I found incredibly cliched in the sense that it was just a 50s sci-fi movie with 80s, you know, effects. But a lot of people loved Alien. It didn't change my mind, but again, I wanted to acknowledge that, you know, that fact. So I try to do that. I think most of our reviews are pretty mainstream reviews. They don't always agree with box office tastes, but I mean, we have a funny review that one of my associates did for Friday the 13th. And the fact that Friday the 13th made millions of dollars doesn't make it a good movie. But we made note of that too, that it was a success, even though we didn't think it was terribly good.
One of the movies showing tonight is Assault on Precinct 13. Maybe you can read the review that you gave it in your book, just to give us a sample of what the what the listings are like.
Well, this is the kind of thing I'd love. This kind of thing makes me feel proudest of the book or the book's existence, which is that if you look up a film like this in a newspaper listing, let's say, you might not really get a sense of its value, because if you just read a dry synopsis, a one-line synopsis, and you read the names of the stars who are totally unknown, you'd say, well, gee, why should I bother to watch this movie? Well, we rated 3.5 stars out of a possible 4, and it was made in 1976, which is not when its distributor says it was made. And its director is John Carpenter, who has since gone on to greater prominence. And we list about 6 cast members here. As I say, they're not well-known people. And the review reads, a nearly deserted L.A. police station finds itself under a state of siege by a youth gang in this riveting film, a modern-day paraphrase of Howard Hawks' Rio Bravo. Writer-director Carpenter also did the music score for this sleeper. So I would hope that would pique somebody's interest and alert them to the fact that though it's a relatively unknown film and though it doesn't have big stars in it, it's really worthwhile. And if I can turn somebody onto that movie, then I feel really good.
When was the first time you saw it?
I'll confess that I saw it on, I think I saw it on home box office, because it did not get theatrical release in New York City where I live.
I think it played here for a day
and
a half.
And that was the first place I saw it. Of course, I much prefer to see it. I would have preferred to have seen it in a theater. But I saw it there and was just riveted by it. Absolutely knocked out. I also must say I think that it's the best film Carpenter has done. I haven't been too thrilled with his subsequent movies. But I think this is an awfully good film. Really sharp.
Many of the newspapers do provide listings for movies and star ratings too. Do you know how those are done? Do they ever lift them from your book, or are those originated at the paper?
Some of them are stolen from my book, which I know for a fact. Some of them subscribe to a TV data service, and I don't know how that service derives its ratings. The New York Daily News, of course, is the granddaddy of all sources for ratings. They've been doing a 1 to 4 star rating system since the 1930s. And there's a TV industry source guide that has created its own star rating system based on box office success and box office value, name value to the film, which is quite another criterion.
So what do you do if you see a newspaper has stolen one of your listings? Will you call them?
I get angry.
And then?
And then the publisher will call them. We've actually gotten some settlements from a couple of fairly prominent newspapers that are copying word for word. I mean, that's what you go. I mean, look, the book is a reference book. It's meant to be consulted by different people, and that's its purpose. But there's a difference between consultation and plagiarism. And those that go over the line, you know, have to be reminded of the copyright laws. And we've done so in a couple of cases.
A lot of movies that are shown on TV are edited because of sex, violence, or language. Do you think the standards have changed much since you started putting together TV movies?
Oh, sure. In our first book, in our first edition from back in 1969, there are a lot of films that we say we added little caveats like, boy, this will never make it to TV, or this will never make it to TV intact. And it's not true anymore. Standards have changed. Even the networks, who are the, you know, the most prudish of all, have changed their standards, even if it's on something as trivial as allowing certain words. I think you can now say, you can now say hell and damn.
Oops, we're off the air now.
Oh, dear. Sorry about that. There go all your fundraising efforts right down the drain, right? You can now say those words on the air, and as innocent as they may sound, you couldn't say those, 10 years ago, or 15 years ago, certainly. And there are a few other words that you can now say. I don't want to do a catalog here, but there are some other words that are now permissible in certain contexts on the air. But local stations have always had their own, have had the ability and the right to do their own editing, their own pruning, and they have to judge their audience. They're under no particular restrictions. They can't show outright pornography or something, and they can't do anything that would violate their FCC license, but they have to judge how far they can go. And there are some cities around the country that are more conservative than others, and so you'll find that the same film may be given different treatment in different cities around the country.
I was watching parts of Chinatown on TV mm-hmm. recently, and the parts that I noticed that were edited weren't sexual or violent. I think it was just them editing for time. Mm-hmm. And they just took out scenes where, like, he'd enter the archives or he'd enter mm-hmm. the retirement home. And it doesn't really progress the story or do anything dramatic, but there were such really lovely moments in the movie. I felt terrible that they were taken out.
I just can't abide it. I really try to avoid watching movies on TV for that very reason. I mean, why should I watch a film and be cheated? You know, when ABC ran Taxi Driver, it was one of the bigger jokes of the 1970s. They should have called it Excerpts from Taxi Driver. I mean, how can you show? We'll do a little quiz. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but what would you say is arguably the most famous scene or line of dialogue in that movie?
Most famous line is, "Are you talking to me?"
Yeah, that wasn't on the network. I mean, do you believe that? That is the most famous scene in the movie, and it wasn't there on ABC. Now, that's just fraud if you say you're showing Taxi Driver and you're not showing that scene, let alone many, many others. It's fraud, and yet they get away with it for two reasons. One is they're able to put up this dumb thing that says edited for television, which covers a multitude of sins. And the other reason is that people are foolish enough to watch. I mean, if people would only get smart and realize that on network television, if a film like Taxi Driver or Coming Home or Midnight Cowboy or Midnight Express or other R-rated films that have, you know, some sort of potent material in them, they're not going to see the films, and that it would be foolish for them to tune in. And if enough people refuse to watch, then the ratings would go down and the networks would learn a lesson. The lesson would either be, we can't show these at all, which wouldn't be such a bad idea, or if we show these, we have to work a little harder to try to conform to their original versions.
I was wondering about that. I figure if I'm not watching something, and if I'm not monitored to Nielsen, and if I don't have an ARB journal where someone is officially monitoring what I'm doing, will it make a difference if I don't watch it or not, if it's also not part of an organized boycott?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
My honest answer is I don't know. I suppose, you know, I like to believe in certain naive things, that, you know, that one man counts and that kind of thing. I guess I'm wrong. I mean, I guess, I guess if you and I tuned out Taxi Driver, ABC's stock wouldn't plummet the next morning. And the sponsor's sales wouldn't take a nosedive. But I think that if it were more publicized, and as you say, if perhaps some sort of movement were to arise, I think probably people have better things to do with their time than create a movement of this
sort. Film buffs movement.
But, if I had my druthers, that's the kind of thing that would happen.
Before you became a writer where you had, like, forums to seriously express your opinions, did you ever mm-hmm. write letters to networks telling them when you were angry? Did you ever do that?
I've written letters in my time. Yeah, I used to be a real avid letter writer, full of, brimming with righteous indignation, I might say. My next letter, formulating in my head right now, is to the president of United Airlines. United Airlines, which is otherwise a fine and perfectly respectable organization, shows its movies on coast-to-coast flights on a 19-inch TV set. And if you're sitting any further back than three rows, you're squinting at a 19-inch TV set trying to watch a movie. Now, airplanes have never been my favorite place to see movies. And in fact, they're just about the worst place in the world to watch movies. But at least you used to have a chance when they projected it on a screen. And now, most airlines are either using video projection, and rather small video projection, or like United, they're showing them on TV sets. I just can't believe it. And with a straight face, they come around and collect your $3 or $3.50 and pretend they're showing you a movie. It's astonishing. So I still write letters.
Well, you have to fly back and forth to Los Angeles.
Yeah, I've logged a lot of miles now.
For Entertainment Tonight. What movies have you gotten to see on the plane?
Well, I won't watch them.
Oh, you don't even, you
no,
don't pay
I just won't bother. No, what is the point, really? I mean, if I try to avoid watching films on a TV set at home, why should I do it on a plane? I've been catching up on my reading instead.
The times I've flown and they've shown movies, they've been movies I haven't wanted to see. It's
mostly
most
that's
depressing.
True. It's films I've seen already. There was one last week I was tempted to see, but as it happened, I had not planned ahead of time. I was about 12 rows back. I didn't want to get eye strain. I decided to pass.
Do you have cable or pay TV in your home?
Yes, I do.
With both or?
Both, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Are new options opening up in your viewing? Or do you feel like the communications revolution has hit for you?
Oh, it certainly has. It certainly has hit. My biggest regret is the failure of CBS cable, actually, which was a darn good service. I mean, they really did excellent programming, not just film. I mean, they did excellent programming of all kinds. They had wonderful music. They had good theater, good dance, good drama, and some good documentaries, too, and good interviews. Wonderful service and some very good films. And I feel very badly that they bit the dust. But I watch Home Box Office from time to time, and chiefly I use it to watch films that never got theatrical release that I'm curious about. And HBO has become the elephant's graveyard for, you know, films that have nowhere else to go. And I guess that is of interest to me because of my particular academic bent and my morbid curiosity to see what these films are like. I will say that in 9 cases out of 10, after watching them, I know why they didn't get theatrical release. But still, I'm curious and I want to see them. And sometimes I use them to work on the book. I use them to get credits. It's very hard to get information about some of these films, and sometimes the only way to get information is to copy them off the screen, copy actual credits off the screen. So I've used Home Box Office for that, and occasionally I'll watch a film, an actual legitimate theatrical film I've missed. But you know, I always prefer to see it in a theater if I can.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes on Saturday afternoons I'll watch one of the horror movies that are on TV, and I'll always consult your book and... They're always in there. Have you seen like all the B films, Leonard?
Not personally, no. I mean, that's why I'm lucky to have good people working with me on the book. I have a few people who are horror aficionados, you know, who help me with the book. I can't stand watching these new horror, the gore films. I mean, I'm very squeamish, and I get very upset at these films, and then I get upset, you know, on other grounds, you know, cultural grounds, moral grounds, things like that. I had to go and see Halloween 3 to review for Entertainment Tonight, and I was furious. The film was a ripoff. The film was offensive. The film was stupid. It really got me angry. I did a very angry review.
So your colleague who edits who writes the horror reviews,
mm-hmm.
Do you ever disagree on how a horror film should be handled?
Oh, sure. Everything gets filtered through my sensibility. You know, and sometimes one of my associates will write a review and I'll question it and I'll say, you seem to be a little overboard on this. Because I try to keep up with films. I try to get a sense of the reaction and the response to them, so that I have a way of acting as a devil's advocate or a sounding board for my different staff people. And I'll say, gee, I thought this was supposed to be a turkey, and you're giving it 3 stars here. And then he'll have to plead the case of the movie, or else I'll ask some other people and try to get a rounded opinion. I take it very seriously. I mean, you know, there's no fail-safe. There's no absolute way. If I had my druthers, I would see every film, and I would write up every film for the book because it's got my name on it. And that would be great, only it wouldn't be great. I'd have to sit through all that garbage. This way, you know, is much saner. And the people who work for me, I trust and respect. And these are people who are really dedicated film buffs and film viewers and who give a lot and are very, very serious about, you know, the write-ups that they do. And they consider them very carefully. So, you know, I feel very, very confident putting them in the book.
Leonard Maltin is my guest, and he edits the TV Movies book in the 1983-84 version has just been published, and it has about 1,500 new movies reviewed in it, including made-for-TV movies. And if you have any questions or comments about movies that you'd like to talk with Leonard about, we're going to open up our phones. The number is 923-2774. We're at area code 215, and again, that's 923-2774. Now, you are now the film critic for Entertainment Tonight, which entails, as we mentioned before, flying across the country every other week. What were the first things you were told that the first time that you were going to record your television review? What advice were you given about how to speak to the public and how to look at the camera and all that?
I can think of 3 words of specific instruction that I received. Make it shorter. really, I went out and auditioned for them, and I wrote, they told me nothing. I wrote a review. I did 2 reviews to audition for them, and I wrote the reviews as I thought the kind of presentation they would want for television purposes, and I said what I believed about the films and tried to make it interesting and, you know, somewhat entertaining. And the only thing wrong with them was that they were running long for their purposes. It's a very fast-paced show, and they have to keep everything very, very tight, and that's frustrating sometimes. For everybody who works on the show, it's frustrating sometimes because if you get really rolling on something, you want to spend more time with it. But then television always has that problem, unlike radio, which has more time to stretch out with. And but that's been the only – and then I went and auditioned the 2 pieces on camera, and they liked them, and they hired me. So that's been about it ever since. I mean, I have tremendous freedom to do as I like in the reviews. They've supported me wholeheartedly, and it's been very rewarding and really very pleasing, and I enjoy working on the show. And also now I've been getting to do some feature pieces, which has been very satisfying to me.
Actually, I saw the one on jazz movies.
Oh, yeah. That
was really fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed doing that. We're going to do a sequel to that.
Oh, good.
In about a month or so.
Mm-hmm. What's that going to be? Oh, more of
on more footage. Of those. They were called Soundies.
Soundies,
little 3-minute
yeah,
films
right.
From the 40s. We're going to do Son of Soundies in about a month.
So what do you ask yourself before figuring out which film to review? You know, because you've got a choice of films. You'll mm-hmm. be covering it for people around the nation who watch the show. You can't.
Well, the first thing
everything.
Is I have to. Yeah, the first thing I have to choose is a film that does have national release, which means that unfortunately I can't cover certain art, what they used to call art films. I guess they still call them that. Foreign films and little independent films that may only be seen in 4 or 5 cities. I would love to be able to shed some light on these films and bring them into the spotlight. But it's also not really practical because the show is seen in 120 cities. And so it's not really right to be, you know, informing people about something they don't have a chance to see. On the other hand, if certain art films start to get around and they get into maybe 15 or 20 or 25 cities, then I feel it would be great to review them because not only will I be reviewing them for the people in those cities, but then maybe I can create some interest that will give it a broader release. So I feel I'm doing a little missionary work, and that's nice. That's been satisfying. But mostly I review the main Hollywood releases, and I choose from them depending on the time schedule, depending on how many openings they have for reviews on the show and the release schedule and that kind of thing.
Would it be fair for me to ask you what you think of your other film colleagues on television, the sneak previews and at the movies hosts?
Oh, well, no, I don't know if it's really right for me to comment. I would say this, that I think that anybody stepping into the shoes of Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel after the whole country had gotten used to seeing them and their style and their approach, I think anybody stepping into that spot would have a terrible time because they're going to be compared. Gene and Roger took time to find their style and to hit their stride, and they finally did, and people liked them and responded to them, and that's why they were successful, and that's why they still are on their own syndicated show. So I think it must be very tough bucking that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I wish them a lot of luck. And I think that, time will tell whether everything shakes out.
Leonard Moulton is my guest, who edits TV movies in the 1983-84 version has just been published, and he's the film critic for Entertainment Tonight. We're going to take some phone calls. If you'd like to ask him any questions about movies or have any comments you want to share with him, our number is 923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air. Hello? Hi, are you there? We connected? Yeah, this... Okay, we're going to try... I'm going to put you on hold in case you're there. Hang on, I'm going to try somebody else. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air. Okay, I'm just going to parenthetically mention to our technical director that I have a feeling the phone might be unplugged. So if someone can come in and plug it in, we'll take care of this. Okay. And while we're getting that
taken
care of...
So, seen any good movies lately, Terry?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. What have I seen lately? What have you seen lately?
I've seen nothing but junk lately, which is very discouraging. Very, very discouraging. Here I am, having to voice an opinion on national television, and it looks like I'm an unrelenting grouch lately because all I keep doing is negative reviews of things. And I'm sure that after a certain point, people start to blame the bearer of bad news for the bad news. But nonetheless, when you sit through, one after another, not just the schlocky films like Halloween 3, but let's see, I don't want to say anything about a film that hasn't been released yet.
It's okay with me.
Oh, Monsignor is a recent release. And... It Came from Hollywood, which has all this...
Yeah, I figured you'd be the one who knew all the films in there.
Well, here's It Came from Hollywood, and it's got all this funny, funny stuff in it. Those clips are wonderful and very funny. But they feel it's necessary to hire, these various comedians to introduce it. And then they try to be funny, too. And they don't succeed too well. And then they even add their comments to the soundtrack to clips that are already funny. They feel they have to add wisecracks, or the producers felt that it was important for them to add wisecracks. And the film, as a compilation, has no sense of form or pace or rhythm. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't have any point. And it just stops. I mean, at the end of 75 minutes, it stops. Dead. In more ways than one. And what a shame, when you had all this good stuff to work with. So that was a little disappointing, though at least that had some laughs in it. Which is more than I can say for a lot of other stuff I've seen.
I'd seen clips of it on TV, and
clips make it look wonderful because the stuff is so much fun.
But it was so highly edited that none of the movies had a chance to really show how spectacularly bad they were because they were gone in 15 seconds.
Oh, National Lampoon's Class Reunion. There's another thing I had to sit through. Boy, boy. I really, not even if you're going to make a raunchy comedy, make a raunchy comedy. If you're going to make a dumb sophomore comedy, make a good dumb sophomore comedy. This isn't anything. It's just awful. So those kind of things really get me down.
Leonard Moulton is my guest, film critic for Entertainment Tonight and editor of the TV Movies book. And let's try, okay. We'll try the phones in a couple of minutes. Do you read a lot about the movie business?
A fair amount, yeah.
What do you learn about movies by seeing what's big box office? Is it important to you to try to kind of psych out what popular taste is at the moment?
It's not important to me in a sense of anything but curiosity. It's interesting to know what people are going to see. I think it's instructive sometimes. To me, one of the most interesting things of the year was the grassroots success of An Officer and a Gentleman. Here was a film, a well-made film, that came along and just seemed to take the country by storm. And I can only assume that it was because people were starved for an old-fashioned romantic drama, something with a story, something with some genuine romance to it, and something you could enjoy and get involved with the characters, and these people made it a big hit, in spite of the fact that it is a throwback, an almost alarming throwback to really corny old military academy and military school type movies. When people talk about, you know, how far we've come and how sophisticated we are today, and then you go and see a film like this, which is just dripping with cliches from older movies, it amuses and surprises me. Well, I mean, no less than the Rocky success, you know, and the Rocky films are kind of like 1946 monogram pictures that have been spruced up a little bit. Doesn't make them bad. It just, again, amuses me. An Officer and a Gentleman, I heard people talking about Lou Gossett's brilliant performance, or that it, you know, rates an Oscar. Well, Lou Gossett's a wonderful actor, and it's a good performance. But even Lou Gossett admitted in interviews that he'd gone and watched Jack Webb in the D.I. You know, this is not a brilliant, innovative performance. This is your standard drill instructor performance, capably done. But people have short memories. And people are starved for entertainment. They're starved for entertainment. They want a story. They want some characters. And this pervasive feeling in Hollywood that all people want is a lot of glitz and a lot of cheap jokes and a lot of special effects and a lot of blood, I think is a self-fulfilling prophecy. If they, you know, if you say it often enough, you'll believe it. This is all people want to see. Well, baloney. Look at the box office figures on Officer and a Gentleman and explain that to me then. Or look at the box office success of on Golden Pond, or a year or so back, Alan Alda's The Four Seasons. And if you say that to I'm not saying that I think those are the pinnacle of movie making, but they are, in a certain sense, old-fashioned pictures with old-fashioned values. And if you say to somebody, well, how do you explain that success? They say, that's a fluke. Those are people who go to the movies once a year. You know, you can't count on them. You know? Well, maybe they only go once a year because there's only a movie like that once a year. There's a real arrogance in Hollywood that I find very disturbing. And of course, they can't wait to just hop onto trends, you know, and make another 10 clones of the last success. That kind of thing is bothersome. So for that reason, I keep up with the business because I want to know what's happening and why.
Yeah. Speaking with Leonard Maltin, who's the film critic for Entertainment Tonight and the editor of the TV Movies book, and there's a lot of people waiting on the line to speak with you, so let's try the phones again. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Okay.
Here
Good.
We go.
Glad you're there. Okay.
I'd like your work for many, many years.
Thank you.
And TV Movies has really given me many, many hours of pure laughing enjoyment. I think that a lot of people don't realize what a funny book it is. Especially when you look in there and then all of a sudden you see the words bomb in these letters. Okay, couple of questions. I have my own opinion on this and I want to match up with yours. I know it's hard to say, but what's the worst movie ever made, in your opinion?
Oh, I don't know. I really don't know. As I say, having sat through some of the stuff I have in the past 6 months, really there's some real competition. I saw a film this summer called Megaforce that is about as awful as anything I've ever seen.
Major is in it.
It's about as terrible as anything I've ever seen.
Uh-huh.
And of course, there's two kinds of bad movies, as you well know. I mean, there are the tacky bad movies, the Plan 9 from Outer Space type bad movies, and then there are the ambitious Hollywood bad movies like Megaforce.
Is The Outlaws, I think, the all-time worst movie ever.
Oh, I don't know.
For example, the second time. Don't agree with that, I guess.
I don't know if I'd go along with that because I've seen a lot that I would find more worthless, if there's such a phrase as more worthless.
two questions. What do you think of the Sherlock Holmes series in general?
Oh, I love them. I love them because even when they aren't good, it's just so much fun to watch Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce and to see the other character actors who are in the film.
The acting in this is great.
Yeah.
And the other thing, since you mentioned On Golden Pond, I never read a review of it. I thought that was one of the worst pictures that I've ever seen. I mean, it just, you could predict everything that happened in it, and it was just, you know, it was obviously made right to the audience. I thought it was just awful. I mean, what did you think of it?
Well, now I'm supposed to be embarrassed, right?
I'm just wondering.
No, I liked it. I liked it. I thought it was enjoyable. I had seen the play on Broadway, and I think the play was a little less treacly than the film. Though the script was done by the playwright Ernest Thompson and was very faithful to what the play had been, I think that Katharine Hepburn was a little more teary-eyed than I would have liked. But I enjoyed it, and I'll tell you, I happened quite by circumstance to see it a second time, and I found that it held up to my amazement. It really did. And I think that it's a very easy film to make fun of and to knock, but I think it was good.
Thanks so much for your call. Okay. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. I have a question. I'd like to know, how does the TV station get the rights to show a movie? For instance, Casablanca. Can any station in Philadelphia area show that? And also, are there any films that are in the public domain?
All right, that's several questions. Well, the way a TV station gets hold of a film is it contracts with a distributor to buy the film, usually for a period of time. They'll contract for the film for 4 years or 2 years or 7 years. Sometimes they'll contract for a certain number of showings. They're allowed to show it 12 times over 4 years, let's say. That's for instance. In the old days of TV, they used to have to buy these films in packages. They would have to take a group of, say, 75 movies. And along with Casablanca, they might have to take some turkeys. Then the government outlawed that, and now, supposedly, they don't sell films that way anymore. In truth, they sort of do. They're still arranged in groups. And what happens is, if a station really doesn't want something that's in the group, they can kind of grumble and say, "Can't you substitute something else?" And the distributor, you know, usually will. But generally, they go in bunches, which is why a station that has Casablanca will most likely also have other Warner Brothers films of that vintage. And that's why you'll see Casablanca repeated on the same station over a period of time. And then if its contract expires, another station may pick it up. And that's how the films are distributed. Yes, films are in the public domain. Films are subject to the same copyright law as books and works of music and everything else for years and years, which was you could copyright them for 28 years and then renew them for another 28 years, and then they would fall in the public domain. A lot of films were not renewed. A lot of silent films and films of the 30s and 40s were not renewed after the first 28 years, and that places them in the public domain.
Thanks so much for your phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
I'd like to say that I enjoy the book. I've got the new edition. I liked it very much.
Thank you.
And I'd like to ask you what you think of the practice. It seems to be more and more in the last couple of years, more and more widespread. They take two or three TV series episodes that are canceled, and they re-edit them into a movie. They slap a new title on it, and they sell it to a local station as a movie. And I'm wondering if you have any comment on that type of practice.
Yeah, I don't like it much for two reasons. One is a very selfish reason. The selfish reason is that then people go and look up that title in my book and they don't find it there, and they write me letters and say, how come you don't have Ransom for a Dead Janitor in the book? And I have to write back and say, because there is no such movie. What they did was they spliced together three episodes of Columbo, and that's what they're calling it. That's the selfish reason. On a broader canvas, I think it's kind of a fraud. You know, they're trying to pass off something as a movie that isn't really a movie. But then TV doesn't seem to care about that. It's just so much fodder to fill up time.
Mm-hmm. Also, what about the fact that now on pay TV, which, you know, you have to pay for, they're playing made-for-television movies that have already been on the three networks?
Well, they seem to have found that people don't mind it if they pick good ones. They did some market research on that, I know, because they were wary of that. They didn't want to have people complaining too much. But they're desperate for films to fill up airtime, and that's why they started turning to that source.
It might be more interesting if they tried to get the rights to old series that people haven't seen for a long time but that they remember.
Well, I'm with you on that. They don't seem to feel so. They want to stick to the feature format, and that's why they do that.
Thanks so much for your phone call. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? I'd like to ask a question concerning the relationship between the movies and the TV. When people sell movies to the TV, do the directors have any control over that? Because you had said earlier that you felt if people didn't watch them, they wouldn't cut them up so much and show them in that edited version. But I sometimes wonder, like, how Francis Ford Coppola can possibly let a network take Apocalypse Now or something like that and chop it up after all the work involved and everything.
Sure. Well, some directors try to write it into their contract that they will have a say or veto power or editing control over their films on television. Other directors have not been given that right in their contract, and so then they're helpless.
So once if it's not in the contract, it's out of the director's hand.
That's right.
Because
that's
of
right.
The distributor's power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And some directors are very vigilant about it, and they supervise the editing of their own films for TV.
Uh-huh.
And, and unfortunately, they still have to conform to the same censorship standards, but they might fight a little harder, and they might get them to bend a few rules. So occasionally, you at least have some integrity beyond that of, a random network censor or network editor going into that.
One thing related to that, I rather enjoy the films that are sometimes seen on public, like local public television,
mm-hmm.
but they don't seem to get into that too much. Is that because of the cost, do you think? Or?
I don't know. I think it's on a station-to-station basis. I think I live in New York City, and our public television station shows a lot of movies and good ones, and it's been a real blessing because they do show them uncut and uninterrupted.
I'd like to see more of that. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks mm-hmm. for your call. Bye-bye. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Leonard Maltin, film critic for Entertainment Tonight and editor of the book TV Movies, and the revised 1983-84 edition has just been published. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. I wanted to ask Leonard, first of all, I wanted to say I really agree with his comments about that comment they say edited for television
mm-hmm.
And the incredible things that happened under that banner. We had seen a really terrific movie called Night of the Following Day,
mm-hmm.
mid-70s, I guess, with Marlon Brando, Richard Boone, and Rita Moreno. And it was a kidnapping drama filmed in France. When they put it on television, edited for TV, they took out a whole swath of it, most of the part that referred to Rita Moreno's drug addiction, and filmed an entire new section that had not been in the original movie. And put it on TV and changed the whole ending around on the thing. It was the most incredible destroying of a really neat film that I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder if you'd seen that one or know of anything like that at other times.
No, I don't know that case specifically, but I do know some others where that happened. Universal Pictures was particularly guilty of this for a while, where they took films that otherwise would have been unsaleable to TV. See, it's always money is the motivating factor here. And they took some films. There was one called Secret Ceremony with Elizabeth Taylor and Mia Farrow. And there was one with Rod Steiger and Claire Bloom called 3 into 2 Won't Go. And there was a little thriller called Eye of the Cat with Michael Sarrazin and Gail Honeycutt. Those are three films that came out all around the same time. And Universal, in all three cases, independent of the director or writer of the original film, shot additional footage to replace and overlap what was in the film in order to make them acceptable in a variety of ways. In the Secret Ceremony, they added a framework of a psychiatrist discussing this case. in Eye of the Cat, they did alternate scenes.
I didn't know they did that. This was really startling to us because we had really enjoyed it when we saw it at the theater.
Mm-hmm.
They had no idea that that kind of thing went on under edited for television.
Yes, it does. And what a lot of filmmakers do now is they shoot alternate scenes while the film is in production they'll actually do alternate takes, like a clean and a dirty version of the same scene in order to protect themselves later on.
Thanks a lot for your phone call.
Hey, thanks. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. I'd like to know if you've ever had occasion to change a review upon reviewing a film for later editions. And second, are you looking forward to the great thespian performance of David Soul playing Humphrey Bogart's part in the projected series of Casablanca?
I can answer your second question first. No. Now let's move on to the other part of the question. No, Casablanca is my favorite movie. And even if they do a swell job, and, you know, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. I don't know why, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, it just won't be the same for me. And so I'm not looking forward to that at all. As to changing reviews, yes, I've done it quite a lot. There are some films that seem to date very quickly. A lot of 60s films that don't hold up, as well as some 1930s films I can think of. And then there are other films that just get lost in the shuffle when they come out or somehow don't seem particularly significant. And as time goes on, and perhaps in the context of seeing other later films, they start to, you know, they something about them comes across. And I have occasion sometimes to discover or rediscover them, or someone on my crew will say, hey, we really missed the boat on this one, and we'll check it out. And yes, so we will change a rating and an opinion. Mm-hmm.
And finally, when 60 Minutes had a tribute, an homage to Casablanca, it was called the best film in the world. Don't you think that was quite a serious mistake to call it best when the word, I believe, should have been favorite or most favorite?
Yeah, I think I might go along with you on that, though I would be hard-pressed to think of anything as the best film in the world. I don't know how you'd ever make that decision. I don't know who would be qualified to make such a statement, really.
Thanks so much for your phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. 923-2774 is our phone number. I'm speaking with Leonard Maltin.
Stand by,
Ernest. And, oh, hi, you're on the air now.
I have two questions. One about movie posters, which I like to collect.
Mm-hmm.
And how they're distributed, because I've called some movie companies and they said they can't sell them, they can't give them away, but they end up in curio shops or nostalgia shops for sale. And the other question is about film distribution. One film that I saw on TV, The Midnight Man with Burt Lancaster,
mm-hmm.
4 years ago, it seemed like it might have been made for a theater and then they changed their mind and put it on TV. And The Black Marble was, I think, directed and produced and whatnot by Joseph Wamba, never got released to the theaters. It was just on HBO, and it was a really good movie. And The Onion Field was distributed for a very short time, and I understand it was also well made, but no publicity, no nothing. It just whipped through town.
Mm-hmm. Well, both The Black Marble and Midnight Man did get theatrical release, but not very wide theatrical release. Apparently not in Philadelphia. They did get some theatrical showings, though, around the country, however minor. So, yeah, they were made for theaters and then turned up on pay TV. As to posters, this is kind of a joke. The studios and the company that distributes most of those posters are not supposed to sell them to anybody, including the theaters. They only rent them to the theaters officially. But it's the worst patrolled business in the world because, as you say, all these memorabilia shops get them. And how does that happen? Well, I think a lot of backs are turned and, you know, I don't know what all goes on. But officially, they're not for sale.
And, could you answer one question that I have?
Mm-hmm.
When The Midnight Man was on, there was some theme music in the movie
mm-hmm.
in the background. You probably won't remember it, but do you know the name of the song and who recorded it?
Oh, gosh, no. I'm sorry. wish I could help you.
I know. Every time it showed, my reception was poor and I couldn't read the credits.
Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is this. I understand that the book, I was listening, the book you wrote is about TV movies, and you also do reviews on regular feature-length movies on TV.
Mm-hmm.
What I was wondering is that there are some movies that are not that easily to go from medium to medium, so-called, like an Apocalypse Now denotes a certain amount of feeling to it on the big screen, but
right.
when taken to a smaller screen, changes quite a bit because it doesn't have the vastness and doesn't give you the same feeling towards it. When reviewing a movie for the book, do you take that into account?
Sometimes we do. The truth is that most movies are made to be seen on a theater screen.
Right.
That's how every movie ought to be seen. And unfortunately, more and more people are choosing to stay home and watch stuff on pay TV.
Right.
I think they're losing quite a bit, and I think that that's true of so many, many, many films. Obviously, though, as you say, there are certain ones that really lose out. Apocalypse Now, I would agree, is a prime example. Another one I could think of would be Days of Heaven, which was such a striking pictorial film that to see that on a little screen would just be to lose so much. And yes, sometimes in our review where that seems to strike us, we'll say really can only be appreciated on a big screen, that kind of thing.
I have one other question. I was recently watching little bits of Superman on TV on Sunday night, and I was noticing that they had scenes in there that weren't in the feature-length film.
That's right.
When they're cutting the movie, do they actually, is this become a thing now where, I don't know how long it's been going on, that when they cut this movie for a feature-length film, they actually cut sections of the movie that they know it's going to be on TV that they'll place in there when it's actually put onto the TV market?
Most of the time, at least up till now, what's happened is they don't plan to use them for the TV version. They end up cutting them from the theatrical feature because the feature's running long, or because maybe they think it's slowing the pace of the film down to have these scenes, and they'll discard them. Then when a network buys the film, the network comes along and says, gee, if we had another half hour in this movie, we could sell that many more commercials. What have you got on the cutting room floor that we could use to pad it out? I think it's a terrible trend.
Yeah.
Because if the director's already made the decision that scene is slowing up the movie, or that scene is not really relevant, or that it's adding fat to the film, you're going against the movie to put it back in, and you're weakening the film and diluting its impact.
Right, that's what I noticed, because it seemed that it just sort of, it was more filler than it had actually anything to do with the actual story that you were watching.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot for your call. We want to get some more phoners in. Thanks for being with us. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hi, I only have one question. I had accidentally saw the film Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and I'd like to know your feelings about it. At the time I saw it, the theater was packed, and the show did keep me laughing, and I was really impressed by the actors and actresses in it.
I really liked it a lot, and I want to tell you, I took a lot of heat for that review. I got some very angry letters from people after I gave it a good review on Entertainment Tonight. People were offended by it and really distressed by it. I mean, I can see that it would upset people who might not want to acknowledge that there have been certain changes in morals and mores, in today's America. Or certainly in Southern California anyway, where the film takes place. But I thought it had a lot of energy and a lot of fun and a lot of originality and terrific performances, very likable and very good, charismatic performances. So I thought it was quite good. Not a great film, but a good film and very entertaining. I think, unfortunately, it suffered from coming out at a time when there had been several high school-type movies. And I think some people tended to just, bunch this with those others. And I think it was a film that had considerably more going for it.
Right, because that's what I thought. My young child had went to see E.T., and I was left with Superman 2 and Ridgemont High. I said, oh, my God, I'm going to see a lot of craziness. But the sex was very mild.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about my teenage days.
I thought it was an honest film, too.
Yeah.
I don't think it was exploitive. I thought it was addressing things that were real. And I thought that the kids were all pretty real.
Right.
Thanks a lot for your phone call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes. I saw two films within the last couple months. Two comedies, Midnight Summer's sex comedy and Tempest.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them I found to be entertaining. I enjoyed them. I thought they were a little bit different than most of the comedies that were around. And I noticed that they seemed to just disappear. Nobody else saw them. Is it just that my tastes are a little out of sync with everyone, or are they really as bad as all that, that they should just disappear? It seems like the people that were with me in the audience enjoyed them.
Mm-hmm. Well,
within a couple weeks, they were gone.
I enjoyed the Woody Allen film very much. I think the reviews hurt that film quite a bit. And I think the reviewers have spent so much time praising Woody Allen and lionizing him that they really expect maybe too much of him. And they were looking for something more significant and something weightier or something more advanced, like a step forward from his last film, when in fact the title of his film told them exactly what he was doing. It was called A Midsummer Night Sex Comedy, and that's just what it was, a little frothy diversion. Not a great work, not a masterpiece, just what it was, just what it said it was. And I thought it was quite good. Tempest, I was not as crazy about, though. I certainly liked the people in it, and I liked the spirit of it, but it didn't work totally for me. But it was pleasant enough to sit through. I think that one just maybe was a little too offbeat for a lot of audiences. It didn't have punch. It didn't have car crashes. It didn't have the kind of people in it who maybe are hot box office types, and so perhaps that's why that didn't really succeed as it might have.
Well, thanks a lot for your phone call. Bye bye. Do you remember the first movie you ever saw in a theater?
I'm pretty sure it was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, not on its first release, but on one of the reissues. And I have this vivid recollection. It's funny how you do remember certain things. I have this recollection of being taken into the theater at the end of the film, like as the audience was changing, by my mother, and seeing this incredibly yellow, this golden yellow. And what it is as the Prince Charming takes Snow White off into the blaring, sun, something like that. And so that's the first one I remember in a theater.
Did it get you to like movies?
It didn't hurt.
It didn't hurt, right? I want to thank you a lot for being with us. Leonard Maltin has been my guest, and his 1983-84 edition of TV Movies has just been published. And if you've just joined us, it's a book of capsule reviews of movies that appear on television, including made-for-TV movies, and it has the running time, the director's name, the leading roles in the cast, and a rating from bomb to four stars, and the reviews are very wittily written, and you can even find films like Shriek of the Mutilated in addition to Casablanca. That's and all your favorites.
I don't know how they're going to keep binding the book. It's become a very fat paperback now. Right. It looks like a Leon Uris novel or something, but as long as the binding will hold, they'll keep publishing it.
And you can also see Leonard on TV, and he's the film critic for Entertainment Tonight. And great to see you again, and thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, at about 2:30, we'll be joined by Catherine Kube, who has written a book about the American hostage experience. At 3:30, jazz critic Francis Davis hosts Interval. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Robert Scheer, whose new book is called With Enough Shovels, The Nuclear Policy of Reagan and Bush. So that's at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and I hope you can join us then. Ken Tucker contributed to today's show. Rob Richards was the technical director. Maeve McGoran's the production assistant. Danny Miller, the associate producer of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Have a great evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered, coming up from Washington, D.C.
Support for this program comes from the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, RKO General, a radio and television broadcasting company, the Communications Workers of America, representing 650,000 members nationwide in telecommunications and other fields, and for historical reporting, the Pew Memorial Trust. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.
And this is Noah Adams, with All Things Considered.
Call it the country with a big sky. You have never been as aware of the sky as you are in Australia. The funny thing is, when you first go to Australia as an American, you're expecting to see a strange version of England because of the accents. And instead, what you see is something which reminds you much more of an earlier America. It's like a looking glass world.
Rick Smolin and 99 other photojournalists looked at Australia through the glass of a camera lens. In 24 hours, they took 96,000 photographs of just about every nook and cranny of the continent. Tonight on All Things Considered, a day in the life of Australia.
And this news, the White House thinking about a January tax cut.
Realtors still watching interest rates, hoping they'll keep going down.
Professional football to be watched again soon, a tentative settlement of the NFL strike.
China and the Soviet Union, the first high-level talking in 13 years. Worrisome for the U.S.?
A strategy for peace in Central America offered by Secretary of State Schultz.
Medical ethics and Korean boxer Duck Koo Kim.
And Picasso's personal prints auctioned in New York.
On All Things Considered, first, here's news.
This is John Hockenberry. The man widely accused of supervising the massacre of hundreds of Palestinian civilians in Lebanon testified today before the Israeli commission investigating the atrocity. Saad Haddad, the leader of the Israeli-backed Christian forces in southern Lebanon, denied, as he has before, that his forces were ever involved. Michael Elkins filed this report from Jerusalem.
Major Haddad told the commission he was certain, sure 100%, he said, that none of his men were in Beirut at the time of the massacre. He himself had been in the city on Friday, September 17th, when the Lebanese Christian Falange units were still in the camps and Palestinian civilians were being murdered. But that was only briefly, on his way to offer condolences to the family of the assassinated Lebanese president-elect, Mr. Bashir Jamayel. Asked to explain why Palestinians fleeing the camps spoke of Haddad's men among the killers, the South Lebanese militia leader said, "I don't know. Maybe some people tried to confuse them. In a panic, people believe anything. And besides," he said, "his forces and the Falange militia wear the same uniforms."
The BBC's Michael Elkins in Jerusalem. Beirut Radio today reported for the second day in a row sporadic fighting between Christians and Muslims near the Shouf Mountains outside Beirut. In an effort to quell the trouble, Israeli armed vehicles sent in yesterday remained on patrol in the area. Slightly less than a third of this nation's factory capacity was idle in a sort of recession hibernation last month. The Federal Reserve Board reported today that the capacity utilization rate was just 68.4%, the lowest level of activity since the Fed began keeping records back in 1948. The figure represents a drop of almost a full percentage point from September. Low factory capacity bears directly on high unemployment. And according to Edward Azim of Chase Econometrics, factory use is a lagging indicator, lagging behind the good news in the stock market and on interest rates.
Particularly for consumers, that a drop in the prime rate does not immediately translate into a drop in loan rates for automobiles and consumer durables.
Lower interest rates do seem to be having an effect on housing starts. They edged up last month by only about 1%. Contractors are now breaking ground on new housing units at an annual rate of 1,120,000, taking into account seasonal fluctuations. Jerry Dunn is the vice president of the Mortgage Bankers Association. He says a real strong improvement will have to wait for better signs from Washington.
Until the deficit comes down, and until Congress and the administration agree to compromise so that they can get the deficit under control, the marketplace will continue to be very skittish, and we don't see that that compromise is in the winds right now.
But the Commerce Department says there are statistical signs of strong improvement in housing construction. In October, 60% more building permits were issued than for the same period a year ago. The Reagan administration's chief economist, Martin Feldstein, today said it will be very difficult for many basic industries to pull out of the recession anytime soon. Feldstein, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, says even if the economy as a whole starts to improve, the steel, automobile, and chemical industries will remain depressed because of export competition. Feldstein also confirmed an administration plan to give Americans the third stage of the Reagan tax cut about 7 months early. President Reagan said in Florida today that to help spur the recovery, he might consider giving consumers the $14 billion tax cut early, on January 1st rather than July 1st of 1983. The president spent most of his time in Florida today rattling the federal saber in the war on drug crime. He visited a hangar at Homestead Air Force Base near Miami and pledged to increase spending for police equipment to, quote, break the power of the mob in America. Mr. Reagan delivered his speech at a table piled high with bags of marijuana, $4.5 million worth, 17 kilos of cocaine worth about $6 million, and stacks of drug money seized by the feds in South Florida. Mr. Reagan said he will open a new legislative offensive to reform laws that he says allow drug offenders to go free. He told his audience of Crime Stoppers about one search by federal agents that turned up nothing until an agent searched in the last possible place.
As they were leaving on a hunch, one of them turned back to the baby in the crib and looked in his diapers, and there was the heroin, the evidence thrown out of court because the baby hadn't given its permission to be searched. And the couple went free.
The president said today the federally financed South Florida Drug Task Force has seized more than $3 billion worth of narcotics. In Alexandria, Virginia today, former CIA agent Edwin Wilson was convicted on 7 counts of illegally shipping arms to Libyan officials. After more than 4 hours of deliberation, a jury found Wilson guilty of smuggling 4 pistols and an M16 rifle as part of a scheme worth more than $20 million in contracts with the Libyan government. I'm John Hockenberry in Washington.
Reports today that the nation's factories are operating at their lowest capacity since record-keeping began in 1948. It's one of several signs that the economic recovery is fighting an uphill battle. And today, President Reagan said he may ask Congress to help stimulate the economy by moving up the 10% personal tax cut scheduled for next July. The president would like to start the cut in January. For the tax cut to go into effect in January, Congress would have to act soon, during the special post-election session later this month. NPR's Cookie Roberts has more.
When President Reagan's Republican troops return to Washington, the leaders will have a list of dead and wounded, 26 fewer Republicans in the House, and many survivors showing the scars of bruising battles. Those Republicans have been saying that the president must hear the word from the battlefield, do something about unemployment, even if it